The truth is actually words do inspire. Words do help people get involved. Words do help members.
Our next guest is Ian Gortz. Ian is currently the program editor for Canada's NATO at the NATO Association of Canada. Ian recently completed his MA, Masters of Arts in Intelligence and Strategic Studies, in Wales. Prior to this, he completed his Bachelor of Arts in Political Science at McMaster University. Ian wrote his dissertation on the role of technological innovation and the intelligence community. His research interests are intelligence and strategic studies, emerging security, international relations of technology, and the internet. He was also a semi-finalist at the inaugural Cyber 9/12 Student Challenge in Europe, held by the Atlantic Council in Geneva, Switzerland. Ian's other interests include sports, comic books, video games, and science fiction. Welcome, Ian. Thank you for being here, Ian. I'd like to begin by discussing the role of technological innovation and the intelligence community.
Right. So I just completed my dissertation on actually this subject, looking at how technology in the past, in the present, and in the future can impact the intelligence community. We've seen a lot of innovations that have changed the way that we collect and analyze intelligence. And as a primary part of, you know, policymaking, especially in, you know, we see the United States with the CIA and the NSA and all those kind of things, metadata, PRISM programs, Tempora, all those type of things are very much in the forefront of international politics right now. Mm-hmm. And so it's played a vital role in changing the way the intelligence community exists as a, you know, a part of the policy process. And I believe that it will continue to do so in the future as well.
Now, as these changes are being implemented and as intelligence and emerging security continues to advance, what impact will this have on international relations, technology, and the internet?
So a lot of that depends on sort of what technologies come out. Right now, it's difficult to say what the next big thing will be. In the past, it's been UAV technologies, unmanned aerial vehicles, weapon systems that can be, you know, unmanned, as well as mass data collection programs have been the two sort of big changes lately. In the future, looking at things like artificial intelligence is one of the next big ones that people are considering. So it really depends on the technology itself, and that's what I think is so interesting about it, is because we're always trying to catch up to what the new technological innovation is, and a lot of the times we're falling behind in terms of what it actually means for policy, what it actually means for international relations, and how states organize themselves and organize themselves to interact with each other.
What challenges do these changes present to the architecture of the international system, its structure, its key organizing concepts, and the relations among its actors?
So there's a lot of challenges they bring. Some of it is sort of at the national level, and some of it is at the international level, specifically looking at things like cooperation between allies. Things like the NSA revelations on the PRISM program in the United States and the intelligence community really challenged the way that the United States dealt with its allies and who would deal with them. So that's one big thing there. A lot of the new technologies create a sort of global atmosphere around them. One of the things about the internet is that it's a global framework. Everyone has, you know, so to speak, access to it. And it's governed in an international way. And those are two fundamentally different concepts, which is very, very difficult. So things like the United Nations or NATO or even a government trying to govern the way that technology exists when it exists in a global space and everyone can have access to it and everyone can do things with it, it really challenges those sort of international frameworks and really needs a sort of new way of thinking about it in order to actually, you know, effectively create policy that helps control it and use it properly.
Right. Changing the processes by the way the international system operates would essentially impact the gathering of intelligence, communication, finance, trade, commerce, policy formation, administration, war, and diplomacy, to just list a few. How would this benefit or not benefit the international system as a whole?
Well, when it comes down to the technologies and the way that they change the processes and how they'll impact things, it's a lot about how we use that technology. Technology itself is inherently sort of neutral. And the ways that we utilize technologies like UAVs and mass data collection and those kinds of things will determine how a lot of those changes take place and what they actually mean, as well as whether or not they're beneficial or not. A lot of it comes down to how we, as members in NATO or members of our nation or the United Nations, how we use those technologies and how our government uses them and how our allies use them. So it's really interesting because it's something that on a case-to-case basis will always be different. Whether it's beneficial or not, the opinion will always change depending on who it is and how the technology is being used, either for them or against them.
Can you provide us with a few examples of where technology has been used effectively and has been managed in an efficient manner by the government? At the same time, can you provide us with examples where technology has been a curse?
One of the big things, actually, I think is a great example of kind of both ends of this, is the mass data collection program that the NSA has sort of just kind of revealed in the last few years. And it's been a great benefit to the intelligence community in the United States in terms of raw data. We've never collected so much data in the past, and for the intelligence community to have access to all that data is extremely beneficial for them. Whether they make use of all of it is a totally different story. And I think that's sort of where you get the negatives as well, is there's issues with things like information overload and significant challenges of legality and morality of collecting that much data about not only foreign governments and foreign allies, but as well as your own population. So that sort of demonstrates the kind of both elements of the both beneficial and not beneficial use of a technology.
Earlier on, we had an interesting conversation pertaining to artificial intelligence and lethal autonomous systems. Tell us more about the implications of such a platform.
Yeah, so this is something that's been really interesting to me and has been sort of catching international spotlight recently with a debate that took place in the United Nations. And there's a lot of implications in terms of morality and ethics surrounding war and that kind of thing, as well as the legitimate use of force. So there's, in terms of morality, is it moral and ethical for us to allow a lethal autonomous weapon system to decide who lives and dies in the battlefield? And it goes back to kind of what I said earlier about, technology in itself is neutral. And, there's arguments on both sides. Some would make the argument that a moral person controlling a robot means that the robot would be moral. Now, there's a whole host of problematic problems with that argument, but there's just as many with the other side who would argue that by introducing, artificial intelligence robots into the battlefield, we would lower the threshold of war, and it would essentially mean that states could pursue war as a much more easy option. And again, there's a whole host of arguments against that side as well. It's a very interesting debate, and it's one that in the next few years will become much more interesting as we become closer and closer to these issues.
Knowing that, what do you think will happen in the future?
It's difficult to say. With technologies like this, I think there will always be those who want to have it on the battlefields. There will always be those who will make the argument that, putting a robot in danger is better than putting a soldier in danger. And there will be always those on the other side who don't believe that, a robot or an autonomous artificial intelligence should be making decisions between life and death. That being said, I think it will find a place. I don't know what that place is yet, but hopefully we'll be able to find out soon.
You've conducted extensive research on this field In addition, you've had your first article published here with us at NATO's Association of Canada called 3D Printing and the Future of Security. Tell us more about this publication.
So 3D printing is something that I've recently become interested in. It was something that came up in the Cyber 912 conference in Geneva when I was discussing with some of the contributors there. And something that was very interesting to me is how a technology that we often take for granted is something that's been around for almost 20 years now, but has only recently become sort of very easily accessible. And how something like that, that we don't normally associate with security, could have such wide-ranging security implications. Often what's talked about is guns and the ability to 3D print plastic or polymer guns that could, you know, potentially circumvent traditional security checks and those kinds of things. But the article that I wrote talks more about the wider, the more widespread implications, effects on regulations and monitoring, as well as anonymity within the international community.
What specific implications would this result in?
Well, it could result in any number of things, but in terms of regulation and monitoring, the ability to 3D print, you know, weapons or improvised explosive devices, or say something that's banned like landmines, would allow, you know, terrorist groups, rogue states, or organized crime to effectively circumvent what has been, you know, traditional monitoring regulation checks that are designed to, you know, prevent these types of technologies from falling into the hands of those people. As well, traditionally we have a sanctioning system in the international community where we try to, you know, prevent certain groups or states from acquiring certain types of technologies or types of equipment. 3D printing could allow a state who has been sanctioned to print components that maybe they aren't able to get because of sanctioning. So it kind of changes the whole landscape because it's a very easily accessible technology that requires you to download a blueprint, print it, and then it's effectively good to go.
As the program editor of Canada's NATO, what future projects can we look forward to seeing and reading from you?
A lot of what we're going to be working on in Canada's NATO is hopefully going to be along the lines of identifying what the Wales Summit means for Canada's NATO. Not just looking at military, but also looking at bureaucratic and political implications on Canada. So looking at really how Canada is going to contribute at all levels of NATO, not just on the military side. Specifically, an article that we're working on at the moment looks at the potential for Canada to take control on a rotational basis of a base in Eastern Europe. That's one of the things that I've been working on that will hopefully be out later this week.
In your dissertation called Technological Innovation and the Intelligence Community, you explain the past, present, and future examination of technological innovation in the 20th and 21st century, along with the impact on the intelligence community. What conclusions have you come to?
So I start out in my dissertation, discuss a lot about past technologies, looking at specifically signals intelligence in World War II, the U-2 spy plane program, as well as the Corona satellite program. What comes out is a lot. Speed is the one thing that I can say that's the definitive trend, is every technological innovation is designed to increase the speed at which we collect intelligence, and that has a huge implication later on about analysis and quality. Eventually, when we get to the sort of present analysis, we look at unmanned aerial vehicles, those kind of things, mass data, and how they've continued this trend of speeding up the process. What has eventually come out is that we're almost going too fast. We don't have the ability to analyze the information that we have. We collect, the intelligence community collects, you know, terabytes and terabytes of data now. We have a sort of permanent presence of the intelligence community, and that's, I think, a big trend in the present. And then looking at the future, looking at how technology like artificial intelligence could return us to a time where not only do we have the speed of the modern era and modern technologies, but the quality that you get from having human analysis could come out with the use of artificial intelligence. So there's a lot of really interesting things going on with technology and how it impacts society in general, but specifically the intelligence community, which has always sort of existed on the forefront of technology and those types of things. Yeah.
Thank you so much, Ian, for joining us. It's been a pleasure having you. We all look forward to seeing what you work on next.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to speak on it.
Maybe you could be a mayor or a senator or a Supreme Court justice. You ready? But you might not know that until you join student government or the debate team. And no matter what you want to do with your life, I guarantee that you'll need an education to do it. Let's go. What you make of your education will decide nothing less than the future of this country.